Attention musicians of all levels. It's not always easy picking out a song by ear. Sometimes you need a little help. Well, I have the app for you. Whether you're a professional musician or a beginner, Ultimate Guitar is an amazing app. For just $2.99, you get the chords and tabs on guitar, bass, or ukulele for over a million songs. They're all available at your fingertips. You also get tools like a tuner, metronome, chord library, lessons, videos, and more. You can find out any song you want. It also has like transpose button. It has auto scroll that you can change the speed to so you can play along with the song. A lot of the songs have the lyrics there so you can sing along with them. Ultimate Guitar is an amazing app. Just go to ultimateguitar.com or download the app to your phone today and start playing. Start playing any song you want. Ultimate Guitar, that's the place for you. Let's get down. Hey gang, it's Johnny. I just want to take a second to talk to you guys about engagement. Right now, you're listening to the show, and I'm not sure exactly what platform you're listening to it on. But whatever platform you're listening to it on, you can subscribe to it and get an alert every time a new show drops, usually every Tuesday and every Friday. New shows every Tuesday and every Friday. Whatever platform you're listening on, be it Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, Overcast, Stitcher, any platform, you can subscribe to it. And if you can leave a comment, leave a star, share it on your social media if it's something that you like, please do that. We encourage you to do that. And also, as far as social media goes, you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter. I am at Johnny Gowdy on Instagram and Twitter. Give us a follow. You can see photos even of my dog, of guests on the show, of different shows I play. Whatever it is that I'm talking about that I've been doing on the show, you'll be able to catch up on through Instagram and Twitter. Also, you can like our Facebook page, How Did I Get Here? Please do. You'll see photos of me with guests that have been on the show. Anyway, all I want to say is, you like a show, share it, use the hashtag, How Did I Get Here Pod. We'll give you a shout out. Thank you so much for listening to the show and engage. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
How did I get here? And now here is your host, Johnny Gowdy.
When we talked.
All right, hello, I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I hope you guys had a great weekend, whatever it is you did this weekend. I know everybody's talking about, it's funny because it's like a war going on. There's like a terrible economy going on. There was like a G7 summit or some shit going on where people are trying to figure out what to do about Putin and all this stuff. And at the Oscars, Will Smith decided to slap Chris Rock, and that eclipsed every other piece of news in the world. It was fascinating. You know, I was watching the Oscars. I was watching it, but you know what happened? The way that I don't know if this is the way it happened for you here in America. My thing just froze. Like he came out, like Chris Rock came out and made the G.I. Jane joke, and then it froze. And then it froze for so long that I stood up and went to go restart my my router because I thought like, oh, maybe it's my router. You know what I mean? Like sometimes you got to, you know, your shit just freezes. By the time I got up to my router to restart it, it came back. And so I went back and sat down and kept on watching it. And I noticed there was a weird vibe. And when P. Diddy said the thing about Chris Rock and Will Smith, I looked it up on Twitter. And sure enough, there it was. The rest of the world got to see it. And I got to see what happened. I was like, holy shit, that's crazy. But here's what I have to say. Okay, look, I get it. I don't condone it, but I get it. I get making a joke about it if he didn't know about the alopecia or whatever. Or just even making it. Everyone in that room was getting made fun of. I'm not saying that it was nice of him to do that. Chris Rock, okay? That wasn't that cool of a thing, okay? It wasn't. But it wasn't like, let's ruin the night completely for everyone kind of situation. So then Will Smith laughed, but then he saw his wife's reaction. Now I get that. I'm a person who has gotten mad, has tried to be protective, has sort of like killed the vibe in a room with my reaction to something like that. That's happened. I mean, I've been in therapy to like, you know, not see red and do things that I will regret moments later. And so I understand, I don't condone it in any way. It was shitty of, you know, for Will Smith to do that. But it happened. And the weirdest thing about it for me is that he didn't just leave. Like, I don't know how you, I mean, obviously he really wanted that Academy Award and he knew he was going to win, but how do you not just leave? Like, how do you stay? Like, having been in a situation, never in that level of a situation where I ruined, you know, everyone's night, but I've been in a situation where I've said something that's upset the room, much less people, but I leave, you know, you leave out of like respect, like, oh shit, I killed the vibe. What am I going to hang out now? Let these guys talk about me for a little while. Come back another time. Reset. He could have reset. He could have talked to Chris Rock backstage. He could have whatever. Anyway, but I'm just surprised that he stayed. And then I have to also say this. When a person gets up and wins an award for being the best actor in the world this last year and starts crying, it's kind of hard to be like, hey, dude, like, I don't know exactly how real this is. This is like super actory of you. Could be super act. It could be. I'm not saying he wasn't feeling it. I'm just saying, like, what a weird fucking thing. And the weirdest part about it, and the thing, like, I think it kind of makes him an asshole for staying and doing that whole trip. Like, that makes him an asshole. The other thing makes him a human being that fucking did something wrong in a moment. Didn't count to 10. You just got to count to 10. That's what I've learned. You count to 10. Slowly. Don't just be like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Bam! But by the time you get to 10, you're usually like, all right, you can kind of see what the consequences of your actions are going to be. You know what I mean? To the room. To the people around you. Because you think about it, you think about Amir Thompson, like Questlove. That guy worked on Summer of Soul like for like 2 years, man. And just got all the press he did for it, everything, every ounce of energy and love he put into that, bringing to light a thing that so many people didn't know anything about. And now so many people know about it. And then it won this award. And then like his experience for that is like trying to change the energy in a room at this, you know what I mean? It kind of killed his fucking night, you know? Anyway, enough about that because everybody's talking about it. I'm not saying like it's right or wrong to do what anybody did that night, because people make jokes about stuff, you can't help it. And people have reactions to stuff, you can't help it. But hanging out and like waiting to win your Academy Award afterwards is pretty weird. And that kind of, to me, that kind of makes you an asshole. And then getting up and crying and doing that whole trip, like I'm this, like, God chose me to go, like, give me a break, bro. Like, you just slapped a dude. Don't be like, I'm chosen to be the river of my people. Whatever he says, I don't know. It was all just bullshit to me. It seemed like he was trying to be like too. It was too actory for me, so that was my vibe. Guys, I had a great show on Saturday night. I got a gig on Friday after this podcast already came out. Somebody was sick and called in sick to their gig at the Continental Club gallery, and I went and played with my friend Nathan Harlan, and we had such a fucking good time. It was like almost. That room, I've said this a lot of times, like that room doesn't really seem like it should be as magical as it is. It's just like a PA and an upstairs place. And you just got to kind of play to the room. And the room filled up with a bunch of people that were expecting to see a different person, not me and Nathan. Most people didn't know who me and Nathan were. And they got on board with our thing. Like, we played a couple of really quiet songs back to back. He did one, then I did one. You could have heard a pin drop in there. For, you know, the 8 minutes that we were playing those songs. Fantastic. Fantastic night. Fantastic crowd. Everyone was so nice. This girl, Aspen, that works at the gallery. I just met her for the first time. Bartender. Fantastic person. It was great playing with Nathan. He's such a great songwriter. Get out there and check out Nathan Harlan music. It was a great weekend. And now this week, Skyrocket gets back to work. If you live in San Antonio, we will be there Friday. We are playing Alamo Heights night. Yeah, the big festival that goes on out there. We will be playing last that night. So come on out. Last time we did that, there was like 5,000 people there and it was insane. We had such a good time. So come on out and do that again. Playing in Houston on Saturday, doing the whole thing. Gang, I have a great show for you today. I do. I have a great, great show for you today. Singer, songwriter, amazing guitar player, Jack Broadbent. He's an English dude that lives in Canada. He's putting out his sixth record, Ride. It comes out this Friday, April 1st, on Crow's Feet Records. You can find him at jackbroadbent.co.uk. He's also about to embark on a tour next week. He starts out next Wednesday, April 6th at Rockwood Music Hall in New York City. I love that place. And he'll be on tour until the 17th. This dude is fantastic, man. I got sent this thing by a publicist. Like, you know, hey, check out this dude. And I checked him out, and his new record, Ride, is absolutely fantastic. Singles Midnight Radio, the song Ride, and I Love You Rock and Roll are all available right now. So you can go check them out wherever it is you stream and download your jams. Go to jackbroadbent.com. So we had a really great conversation about just about his journey as a musician. His dad's his bass player. His dad was a musician growing up, and that's kind of how he got into it. And his dad plays bass with him. He's coming out on this tour with him. Super cool how he made his record with this guy, Mark Gibson, in Quebec. That's where Jack Broadbent moved with a lady. He's also toured with Ronnie Wood. He's toured with Peter Frampton. He had some just great, I mean, really cool shit. He's got a great slide style that to me, there's this like Little Feet vibe. He's playing on this tour. He'll be doing some shows with Little Feet, opening with them and playing on stage with them for some songs. But there's a real like Lowell George kind of vibe to his slide playing, which I really enjoy. I love it. Anyway, Jack and I had a really great conversation via Zoom. It was great meeting him. He ended up writing me a DM on Instagram afterwards saying, hey, great meeting you. And I'd love to meet him when he comes down. And I think you guys will really enjoy this. This is me and the artist Jack Broadbent. Let's get down.
Is this just an audio podcast or is it
yes.
Video as well?
It is audio.
It is. Okay. Well, yeah, that's fine. I just wasn't entirely sure, so I didn't know if I needed to go and do my hair and makeup, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's all good. Sorry, what's your name? Sorry.
My name is Johnny.
It's Johnny. All right.
Yeah, Johnny.
Lovely to meet you, Johnny.
Lovely to
thanks
meet you.
Thanks for having
Jack.
Me on here.
Of course, man. It is really, I just heard about you through your publicist, and it's weird because it seems like you're like rock and roll enough, and like, I'm in Austin, Texas.
And oh, cool.
You sound like you're from here. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, I'm actually from the UK.
Right. No, I know. But like your music sounds like, when I went and listened to it, I was like, oh, wow, shit, this guy's really got the American... like rock, especially this new record. I went back and listened to your older records some too, but this record Ride is fantastic, man. Great songwriter.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Thanks very much. Yeah. Are we on now or do you want to, do you want to save this for, we're going.
No, we're going.
Cool. Well, I really appreciate that. I put this record together in a slightly different way than I've done some of the previous ones. So, it's got a little bit more edge on it.
What? Yeah, talk about that, because it was just you and another guy cutting it, right?
Yeah, primarily, yeah. So what we did was we learned the songs, kind of, we learned the structures of the songs, and then we just smashed them out live. So it was drums and guitar recorded in about a 10 by 12 foot room. So no separation on the instruments. So there's, you know, all bleeding on top of each other. So you got that real sense of like a live band feeling. And then literally sent them over to the UK and my father put the bass down on them.
Right. Cause your dad's a musician as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he put the bass down on them, sent them back and we went and we mixed them and, a couple of overdubs and we mastered them. So that's sort of, I think that's why the record's got that kind of, edgy sound to it. It really was as close to as live as possible as we could make it during, you know, lockdowns and all that,
right.
All that business, you know?
Well, there is like a fire in the performance and now, there's a fire in the performances. Like you definitely, yeah. Like you play like not like you're pandering in any way, but like you're trying to prove something, like you put it all in there.
Yeah. Well, Well, the other interesting thing is that there's two interesting things about the way it was recorded. Is one was that they were all first takes. Every single track on the record was the first time we decided to record them. So that, in a sense, was that we were on edge when we were playing them, because that became a little mantra, really, was that we always knew we were capable of getting them first takes. And the other thing is with doing it like that in the room, with all that bleed, obviously we'd just do guitar and drums first, and I'd kind of like mouth the lyrics at him, you know, so we were just getting those raw tracks down, and then straight away I'd put the vocal on top so we could get a real nice clean vocal, amidst the live chaos. So that was nice. And the second happy accident was that when we came to structure the pieces into what would become the running order, I just had them all in a Dropbox, folder. My friend Mark said, put together an order that you think works. I sent him back an order and he said, that's funny. That's the order we recorded them in.
Oh, really?
So without any planning at all, we'd just got a list of songs, and it was just like, all right, well, we did that one yesterday. Well, let's try this one today. And I think what we were sort of unknowingly doing was kind of curating based on, having a bit of differentiation, having a bit of an ebb and flow, and that's exactly what we ended up with.
Right. Where are you? Are you in the UK?
No, I'm in. I'm in Quebec, in Canada.
Okay. Because that's where you made the record, and that's where Mark Gibson lives, the guy that you're talking about that you made the record.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. Yeah, and that's where I sort of come back to for, in between tours and stuff like that. I just live up here. Mountains.
What brought you to Canada? That you weren't getting in the UK.
A very, very particular woman.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, well, that's always the way, isn't it?
Sometimes, yeah.
No, I just find the place very, very creative for me. And I find after touring in the States and going around all the major cities and stuff, I just love it. I'm literally just across the Vermont border, so you can picture what the scenery is like here,
Oh, yeah. I've got a buddy that lives on the other side of Canada, this guy, Jeff Plankenhorn. You guys should, he's a guitar, hero as well. And
wonderful.
He actually had a dobro kind of guitar made for him called the Plank that he plays standing up. It's like flat. Yeah.
Sweet.
So you live there year round. Did you just tour like in the fall here in the States?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, and a little bit afterwards too, with Little Feet.
Yeah, tell me about that, because did you grow up listening to them?
I did. Yeah. Well, my father sort of had, they were his favorite band. So for me, growing up, it was always on in the house. It was a lot of Little Feet, Steely Dan, Doobie Brothers, those types of bands. And there's so many crossovers between all those bands too, like Captain Beefheart and stuff, all the players seem to intertwine and the band and all that.
Yeah, yeah. But, seems like Captain Beefheart would be like where everybody went to blow off steam, because no one was, they didn't care if they sold records or not.
Well, yeah. I believe Roy Estrada played bass in Little Feet and then moved to Captain Beefheart. He was the original bass player. Yeah. And then they all came out of Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. So I think it was all a big scene, getting the chance to tour with them was just crazy, and obviously the level of musicianship's unreal. I've been playing Willin' in my set for years because I just love that song, and so they'd invite me up for the encore to sing that with them, which was pretty surreal.
How surreal is that? That's fucking insane, dude.
Yeah It was pretty weird. And then we went to do this, they do an island gigs trip every year. They go to Jamaica.
I saw that, yeah.
And so we went out there, and at the time I hadn't seen my dad in 2 years because I'd sort of got stuck in Canada during the pandemic. So I flew my parents out to Jamaica, and we were part of the festival out there. And we even played on stage, me and my dad, with the bass player and percussionist from Little Feet joined us on stage. So it was all just,
dude,
you know,
that is awesome.
Point, at this point, it's just all a bit crazy, you know, like, yeah, I mean, particularly for my father, because a lot of the acts that I'm going out with are stuff that he was, you know, listening to when he was when he was younger than me, you know.
Yeah. How old are you?
I'm 33.
So, man, you're a young guy. Like, to be as entrenched and you know how you can pull out the posers when they're playing the kind of music that you play, like authentic roots based music. You can tell the guys that are jive.
Well, phoning it in.
Well, not phoning it in, just not like the real deal. But it's interesting. Like, I guess you got your musical influence from your dad. But what were you thinking of, like, the pop music when you were growing up?
Well, I mean, there was some pretty good pop music when I was growing up. If you sort of want to consider some of the better bands of the Britpop era, so, you know.
Oh, shit, yeah.
I mean, there was some quite creative bands like Radiohead and,
yes,
you know, I like Supergrass quite a lot. I think they're pretty much in a good rock and roll vein, you know.
Yeah, one of my favorites.
Yeah, Blur and Oasis, you know. I mean, there was all that rivalry stuff going on. But as the years have gone on, I've realized, you know what, they were all great bands. So, you know, I had those influences, you know, as much as it's a swear word now, but like early Coldplay was fantastic. Their first album, Parachutes, was wonderful. I mean, before they kind of pissed off all the purists and went a bit too poppy, but, you know, it was really, by the time I was about 14, I started listening to Steely Dan and Little Feet and Madubies and all that. And then it was like, ah, right. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Then you realize that there's a larger world outside of that. But, you know.
So when you started out playing drums.
Yeah.
Was your dad a professional musician? Like, that's how he made his living?
Yeah. Well, before I was born, he was in a band called Bram Tchaikovsky, and
right.
They played quite a bit in the States. They used to tour with like Rory Gallagher and people like that. So, I mean, my dad was sort of steeped in rock and roll, and when I came along, you know, he'd come off the road to have a family, but of course he was playing in local bands, and all the local bands in the UK down the East Coast where I'm from were all, you know, shit kicking blues bands and, you know, pub blues bands. So that's kind of where I sort of first heard it all and got, you know, I used to get butterflies in my stomach listening to my dad playing with these bands, you know.
So was it like Lowell George, like, was it like that? There's this tone that he had in his slide that was kind of screaming. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, it's funny, the slide thing, because I get asked a lot who I listen to as a slide player. And I guess really the only influence I would have subconsciously had was probably someone like Lowell George, because I didn't start playing slide guitar until I was probably about 20 years old.
So it wasn't like, who's that guy? Shit, I'm drawing a blank on his name. There's a couple of guys. There's a couple of guys that do the sit down.
Right. Yeah, no, I just did it because I found it to be I went in a guitar shop one day, and I always used to play in these drop tunings and stuff. You know, I was always playing in Dadgad and stuff like that.
Right.
And a guy, he's actually a friend of my dad's. He said to me one day, he was like, you know, you're only a semitone away from, you know, just an open slide tuning. And he chucked a slide on my finger, and I tried to play it sort of upright style.
Sure.
I always felt like I was like peering around the corner trying to do it, you know?
Yeah.
And when he was teaching me, just in terms of the simplicity of like just learning a few basic moves, I just laid it on my lap and went like, oh, so like here. And then it was really just about doctoring the technique of the right hand to not be playing from an upright perspective and just, you know, coming across it sideways. And I just felt like, well, it, instantly sort of fell into my lap.
Well, it is. I mean, it's easier. It's like a piano that way. You know what I mean?
That is exactly how I usually explain it. Yeah, it's more like a piano, and yeah, it's all there visually too. And I think you can play in ways when you're holding it over the top like that instead of having it on your finger. There's certain dexterity things. I mean, I use quite a bulky object. I use a hip flask to play with, but personally, because it makes it more of a wrist action thing than like pinching it between your fingers, you know?
Right.
So that was like another advantage, was that there's no way I could play in that style if it was upright, you know?
Right. Whenever I've done that shit, like in the studio and stuff, I've always put it on my lap as well.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think it's visually compelling for the viewer too. Yeah. You know, they almost get a better view as well, you know?
Yeah. So you started out on drums. How old were you?
Well, much younger than when I play guitar, probably 10, 11 or something like that. Yeah. Before my teens.
And then you started playing with your dad. Like, did you play gigs like at places where you, like a little kid, showed up with his dad and played drums?
Yeah. Yeah. I used to play drums like in blues bands with my dad, you know, we're playing stuff like Little Walter and stuff like that with my dad's friends, you know.
That's killer, dude.
You know, a proper Chicago blues. I mean, I've got a mean shuffle, man.
I mean, if you were playing with grown-ups, you must have been pretty good at an early age, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. My dad always said, you know, the only way to get better is to play with people that are better than you, and I think that certainly was my vocation.
That's right.
You know, I would rather... I'd rather have done that than be messing around with people my age who, so like, you know, all of us kind of clueless. So it hooked me in quick. And then when I sort of, it was really the songwriting element that got me off the kit and playing guitar and, you know, picking up the piano a bit more. It was really because I wanted to write songs.
Right. But what made you want to stretch out on guitar? Because I'll say this, because the way that it was sent to me, because I didn't know who you were, right? I have this podcast. I'm a musician. I talk to other musicians. Yeah. I've been doing this for like 10 years. Now publicists and shit reach out to me. So when it comes to me, it's like guitar virtuoso guy has new album. And then I'm like, oh yeah, I mean, you're a fucking amazing guitar player, but I think you're like a songwriter guy and a great singer. Like you're like a great singer songwriter, but you also have some badass licks.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, this guitar virtuoso thing, I mean, it's as flattering as it is. I mean, I think I've just got a particular style, you know. I mean, if you chucked me a Les Paul and throw me in the ring with like Joe Bonamassa and Eric Gales and all these people, I'm going to stand there looking like an idiot. But if you chuck me a slide and stick it on my lap, I reckon I could hold down for a couple of bars.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's stylistic. But that's stylistic. That's not, you know, that's not this idea of, you know, like, well, can you play a million notes and,
right,
you know, in a minute and all this. That's not what I do. You know, that's not what I want
to
do.
To me, the thing with like blues based rock guitar is that you sort of you're speaking the same language as others, but you have your own accent, like your own colloquialism to it. Like you have your own spin on it.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good way of putting it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and it depends what tools you use. I mean, I like to use a metal flask because on the side here, because of how much I've used it, it's become so lacerated that all I got to do is run it across the strings and it starts to give a kind of distortion sound. So distortion sound. So, I mean, using that as a tool is very different to, you know, using a glass, you know, or something that's very, you know, smooth. But I always seem to sort of still get the same accent, just maybe with a different tone of voice, you know.
Yeah. You know, I lifted this thing that sometimes I'll still do if I'm playing with somebody else, but I lifted this thing from Johnny Greenwood, watching him on like playing live on 120 minutes like from the Benz era Radiohead. And I had it on videotape, and he did this thing where I was like, what the fuck is he doing? Man, it took me like a week to figure it out watching it all the time. He took a quarter and took, you know how like a quarter, an American quarter has edges that are lacerated as well?
Sure, yeah.
If you run that on your strings and use like a lot of distortion, some good delay, and a volume pedal, you run it on there, and it works as its own little thing going up and down the strings.
Yeah. Does he do it on the end of Just? Is that what he does?
No,
on
the it end was of the in tune? High and Dry, like in the verses. He was like this real high, screaming, like weird guitar thing that he controls with the volume pedal. Yeah.
Nice. Well, I mean, he
nerds.
Exactly. I mean,
we're nerds, man.
I remember seeing an interview with Johnny Greenwood years ago, and him basically saying, like, someone saying, asking him about his guitar playing, and him, and his response was perfect. He said, "Well, I can only play Radiohead songs."
Right.
And they went, "Well, of course you can play everything." He goes, "Yeah, but I don't learn it." He's like, you know, he's not going to sit around learning Sweet Home Alabama or something, you know.
Right.
Because, you know, and it's like, it's kind of like with me, you know, I know my songs. Sometimes I have to relearn my songs because I forget my songs. But it's, you know, when you approach from a non-theory point of view, and you're a field player, then really I think that's where also this idea of virtuoso is quite laughable in some ways, because virtuoso almost suggests that you've got this encyclopedic knowledge of your instrument.
Right.
Well, I've got just a very encyclopedic affinity with my instrument. You know, it's not anything that I've got written down anywhere or particularly memorized. You know, it's all just it's all just waiting and hoping to come out, you know.
Yeah. And you've gotten to do some touring with like some good some guys that are that like not Yngwie Malmsteen kind of heroes, but like Frampton and like Ronnie Wood, like guys that are like great, have great feel and write great songs.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah, the it was really. I actually also toured with Tony Joe White before he passed away.
Oh,
that was amazing. You know?
Amazing. Did you get to meet Ronnie or Peter?
Oh yeah. No, a lot. Yeah, no, Ronnie's great and was very encouraging. Peter, I met when I did a tour with Peter and Skinhead. Actually, it was like a double header. I was the opener. That was wild, you know. That was my first ever tour in America, was with Skinhead and Peter Frampton.
No shit.
Yeah.
Did you had a band, hopefully, right?
No, I went on with the slide guitar and played half an hour of shit kicking blues and singing my own songs. You know?
How was that, man?
Like, it was wild. To 18,000 people.
Yeah, like that's a tough thing to do on your own.
Well, I mean, I make quite a lot of noise. On my own, you know, I predominantly I tour solo, so unless I can afford to take my dad out, you know, because he's worth it, you know. I've got a pretty eclectic one man show, in the sense that, you know, with the slide stuff, it's pretty loud and pretty rocking, you know. And then I've obviously I sort of offset that with quite a lot of more folky, you know, folk acoustic music.
I kind of
almost do like one for one. You know, I got two guitars on stage. I'd play one slide one, and then and some more acoustic one.
Right. Do you have? Because there was one of your songs from your older records had a stomp in it, and I was wondering. I was like, I wonder if he does this when he plays by himself. Like, has like one of the like the piece of wood or some shit down there.
No, but I've got quite a heavy right hand, so when I'm sort of chugging, it's more an attack on the strings, really, but it definitely creates a backbeat. So I've never really gone for the stomp box thing, just because I feel like as soon as you're kicking a stomp box, if you stop kicking it, then everything drops out, you know. And
exactly.
Whereas if you're just doing it all from your hand, then you've got a bit more of ebb and flow, you know.
Yeah. Dude, 10 years ago, I got like this solo residency at this place, and I had this guy build me this kick drum. He was building kick drums out of suitcases, like old like 60s suitcases. So I had this thing built. I still have it. That was the thing. Well, the other thing too is like I didn't start out as a drummer, so if I'm going to get up there and play and sing, it's either going to be four on the floor or nothing. And then I thought, like, do I just use it at the end? Because if I, what am I going to play this thing doing four on the floor the whole show? Like, what, that's going to suck.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You end up sounding like the White Stripes or something.
Yeah.
But like, and I mean, it would sort of be advantageous to my style because as a drummer, I'm a field drummer. You know, I didn't really learn my rudiments. You know, I was all about the playing, not about learning how to do it. You know, I just wanted to get playing. So, pretty much what my right hand does, my right foot does anyway. So it would kind of would work.
Right, right.
A lot of the time I kick the stage so hard while I'm playing, I'm still kicking the floor that it picks it up on the mics anyway. And then you get that nice little interplay between the guitar and your foot rather than something dominating underneath. Interestingly, that's kind of why I like playing with Mark Gibson. Why I chose to play with Mark Gibson is because he's got a very similar feel to me. And he uses these kind of like brushes that are kind of like plastic whips instead of hot rods. He uses these, they're a lot looser. And he can get them to sound great. You know, he can make them sound almost like sort of like a Motown drum kit if he wants to, you know? But what I found was it never got in the way of my metronome, my click with my right hand. Right. We always sort of mix the snare lower than a higher pitch thing, so my guitar cuts higher, his comes underneath, and you still feel like you get to hear me playing guitar, you know.
Right.
Whereas a lot of other drummers who use sticks and stuff, it's really difficult for me to get that to be able to keep my identity of feel, you know.
That's interesting, man. I fucking like that whole, like, when hot rods came out and people started recording with them, like fucking Wonderwall, where the sound of the hot rods hitting each other are louder than them hitting the snare. That's like, I can hear it on recording. It drives me fucking nuts, dude.
Yeah. Yeah. My friend, I used to record with every night, you'd be playing and all of a sudden you'd go stick. Stop.
So let me ask you this. Cause when you work, when you have some kind of thing that is in the blues, then all of a sudden the audience, there's like a group of people and they're like the blues police, right? Like, I don't know if you know Gary Clark Jr., but we've had this conversation where, like, he started out, like, you might've started out elusive enough and you might be in the rock world enough where you don't get like the second that guy decides to use a synthesizer and a drum machine on a song, it's like, you know, people go nuts on him. Like, they get all pissed off.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so he came out of like Antones, didn't he? In Austin, right? Yeah. Well, I can imagine it must be difficult then because people do expect you to follow that lineage of like, you know, but then saying that, I mean, you could argue the same thing about how people treated Muddy Waters and Little Walter and all that, you know, that they was when they first electrified the guitars, getting shit from the purists I suppose it's like, you know, are you being authentic to the music? Cause I feel like, obviously we all probably feel like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and, Little Walter are a great next step from Robert Johnson and Son House and all that. So, I mean, as long as, because I feel like it retains its authenticity. So I think as long as, if you're bringing something new to the blues, it's still fucking good, then, I mean, music's got to evolve, hasn't it? I mean, it evolved into rock and roll. I mean,
right. Well, someone must have been mad, like when a guy, you know, whipped out a wah-wah pedal in the late 60s or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so in regards to what you're saying about, you know, like Gary Clark Jr. using synths and stuff, it's like, well, if he's using them well and if it's helping him to say what he's trying to say in a different way, then I think, yeah, use him, you know.
Yeah.
I think the difference with me though is that I'm not really coming at it from a rock perspective. I sort of have done for this record, I am now, but I always had this I always had this more of a connection to acoustic stuff, to folk music, you know, to that style of songwriting. I love Nick Drake, John Martin, Joni Mitchell, Neil Young, all that stuff. So for me, I was always able to kind of just bend the blues in a little more of a melodic direction, which again, you might say, and this is where I got beef, I'd be playing gigs and people would all of a sudden be like going like, oh, play slide, you know, rather than listening to some of them. But really the only reason I'm sort of moving away from that three, you know, like that three chord setup was to write more interesting material.
Yeah. Well, you're growing as an artist, you know, with every record. What is it, your sixth record?
Something like that, yeah.
That on the song Hard Living, that epic solo outro thing is very in the spirit of Neil Young.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. It's a raucous cacophony, isn't it?
I bet that was fun to do, huh?
It was, yeah. And again, it was kind of just a thing of like, you know, we were playing them live. So me and the drummer just kept looking at each other and we'd get to, you know, that section. We knew we were going to do a long section and have a build on it and stuff. But I don't think either of us planned on playing it that long. We were going to put like a fade out on it or something. And the more we were looking at each other and like goading each other on, the more the sort of fills kept coming. And then these sort of, you know, that was very advantageous to suddenly sort of start looking at structuring a solo over a really long period, you know, like building it real slow. And no, I love it. That's probably one of my favorite tunes on the record.
That's awesome, man. Hey, so you said you did that tour in the fall. What was your what did you do during 2020? What was going on then for you?
That's when we were recording.
Oh, okay.
I think, yeah. We're 2022 now, yeah. So, yeah, that, yeah, I believe so. It's all a bit of a blur the last couple of years now, isn't it?
Isn't that weird? Yeah.
Yeah, it's difficult to kind of piece it together. I mean, basically the record took a year from like, you know, me and him jamming in a cabin to go into his place, knocking the tunes out and getting them all finally mastered. So it was quite a... I think that's quite quick by today's standards for getting through a whole project. Because we didn't set aside 2 weeks and just knock them out. You know, we'd work on them over the course of a few months.
Yeah.
You know, like I've a good enough time off to sort of like let them breathe. I think having that amount of time to record and not having to worry about cutting that up and going on tour. Because the album I did before that, Moonshine Blue, we recorded half of it in Nashville with the current piano player from Skinhead. And then...
Oh, yeah. Wait, that's not Billy Peter Powell? Keys.
No. It was with Peter Keys. Billy Powell, I think... Billy Powell die?
Man, I don't know. So many people died too. I can't keep up with it, man.
Well, that's... Yeah, no, Peter Keys took over from Billy and he does a great job of it. But anyway, I digress.
Dude, that's killer, though.
Yeah, well, we did half the record... Well, we did the majority of the record there and then we had to go on tour. And so it sort of cut up the sessions and then it was difficult to get back down to Nashville. So I actually finished it in a different studio in Montreal. And although the process worked... I kind of felt like it was a bit fragmented, you know, and I do prefer to kind of like see it through with one party of people. And, you know, that's why working with my friend Mark here was just great because it's just me and him like mad inventors, you know, squirreling away and getting it done.
It's fun to do it like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And not having a producer. So we produced it ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. Here's another question I have for you.
Hit me.
Wait, there was a song. Oh, I Love Your Rock and Roll, which is one of the singles that you put out.
That's right.
The pre-chorus and chorus of that song fucking remind me of Van Morrison. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like in the best way possible. And I don't mean to keep on saying like this sounds like this, but I'm saying this because it reminds me of great shit that I love.
Right. It's funny that you're not the first person to say that. And I love Van Morrison and, you know, Moondance and Astral Weeks are two of my favorite records. I just, that's a deep cut, of an influence that's obviously seeped in and seeped out again. Because I don't know what I thought I sounded like, but if it sounds like Van Morrison, I'll take it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like the buildup of the chords and stuff. So so when you go do, like, you're starting off this tour that's coming up in April, you're starting off at Rockwood Music Hall?
That's right, yeah.
And then you're doing solo stuff, but then you're doing some of the shows with Little Feat.
Yeah, and I'm actually going to be I'm going to fly my father out for that tour. So it's just going to be me and him as a duo playing. And I can't wait because we, like I said, we make a lot of noise. I make a lot of noise on my own in terms of I've still got rhythm. When you add the bass in there too, I mean, it's questionable whether you even need drums.
That's really cool.
Light percussion works best when we start playing. But yeah, we're going to do that. Couple of dates with Little Feat, and that'll be that for a little while. Then we're gonna go over to the UK.
Do you do the rest of Europe as well?
Well, we're just gonna do a couple of dates right now. We're gonna do a couple of dates in the UK. We've got a really nice festival over there called the Black Deer Festival, and then I think we're gonna do a run of dates, and then we're actually coming back and doing a run of dates on the West Coast.
I saw
in
that,
the
yeah.
States. Yeah. So yeah, I think mainland Europe we're not going to do this year. Which that's all right with me, you know, there's a fucking war going on in half of it.
Oh yeah, how does that slip my mind? As soon as I get in these conversations, I forget how terrible the world is. Because I'm just getting to know some cool musician.
Yeah, no, it's cool. I think at the minute it's nice to concentrate on the UK and the States for me. You know, that's kind of where I like to pitch what I'm doing the most. You know, and I haven't been back to the UK in about 2.5 years, so it's going to be great to go and do some gigs over there.
Yeah, you have an American booking agent?
Yes,
that's awesome. Yeah. You should. Come down here, man.
I have. Yeah, no, I'd love to. I mean, so you've just had South by Southwest. And
yep. Have you ever done that?
Yeah. No, I haven't. And it's on my to-do list. So I'll have to bug them about that for next year, maybe.
Yeah.
But I've played at Antone's.
You have?
Yeah. That was a couple of years ago. And I loved it. I think I was supporting Guitar Shorty.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, that place is. It's funny because that's not the actual. The physically, that's not the place.
Yeah,
people
that's
told
right.
You that right?
Yeah. So it's off the it's just off the main drag down the road. That's the one I played in. So yeah, is the old place now like a petrol station or something?
No, it's some kind of ecological washateria.
Huh.
Like some place to wash your clothes that uses less water than most of, but you know, to think that like everyone,
it could be worse.
Right. Right.
But it could be like an evil laundrette.
Right. Right. But you think about it, like every King played on that stage. Bono played on that stage. Like, I mean, just like anybody you can think of, you know, basically in music, that Bonnie Raitt's favorite place to play in America apparently was that stage.
Wow.
She's a great player, man. She's got a new record out. You like her?
I love Bonnie Raitt. Yeah. Yeah, very much.
Yeah. She's
well, I mean, and I was first introduced to her voice, obviously, listening to Little Feat records.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Because she was her and Emmy Lou doing the backing vocals on it. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
What? Who was the drummer of Little Feat? Richie Hayward? Is that?
That's right. Yeah.
Is he still? Who plays drums with?
No. No, he passed away. So they've actually got now. They've got so the two new replacements. The younger guys in Little Feat is Scott Sherrard plays guitar and sings, and he played with Greg Allman for a long time, and Tony Leone is the drummer, and he's great, man. He's like part of that whole Woodstock Lee Von Helm crew. So he played with Lee Von Helm for a long time. And he played with, I think, Chris Robinson. with the Black Crows and stuff like that. Yeah, he's a great drummer. And they're really bringing the spirit a Little Feat, and you can see it in all the other guys' faces that they're just, you know, they've had a reawakening and they've sort of, you know, reignited the rest of the band, you know, which I just think is just perfect. You know, they want to celebrate these songs. They've got those amazing original members like Bill Payne on piano and, you know, Fred Tackett, Ken Gradney and Sam Clayton. You know, they're a hell of a collection of musicians, you know.
Who was the dude? There was a, like, I remember getting this record and kind of like a group, like whatever my group of friends was into it. But it was like in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
They got back together and they got a new singer. Is that the same guy, or that's a different guy than who they
have? No, that was a different guy. I can't remember his name.
That record was really fucking good, I remember.
Right. Most of my father's records, I mean, I was born in 1988, you know. But the stuff I was pillaging off my dad was all the 70s stuff, you know, like Feats Don't Fail Me Now Dixie Chicken and stuff. So that was mainly everything I listened to, essentially, was with Lowell George. The guy that they've got playing with them now, Scott Sherrard, he really, really rips on guitar, and he's got a massive voice, so he's able to kind of approach some of that traditional, more outlandish Lowell George stuff, as well as all the sort of like jazzier, funkier stuff that they did later as well. You know, so it's a great band. What can I say? I'm so proud to have been involved with the touring and with them.
It's an exciting thing when you're in that zone. I get to play with a couple people that I grew up listening to, and like,
right,
when you look over and you're singing the harmony of like some song you grew up singing, you know what I mean? When you're just like, holy shit, that's the dude right there.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's crazy. Well, that's it. And like, you know, especially like Bill Payne, piano, his piano playing is just so distinct.
Totally.
And even just, you know, the look of the man's so distinct. It's like, that's him.
Yeah, that's the guy. And I'm up here with him doing the thing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's great. And obviously with that era of musician, you know, off stage, they're just as cool, you know, as they are on stage. They've got the best stories in the world.
Yeah.
They've got the best stories in the world about going to play the best gigs in the world with the best bands in the world. And it's just a joy to just shut up and listen, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that weird about this business? Like, if you go through and you ascend and you get to meet people that are at the higher ends of it, the higher you go, usually the cooler they fucking are. I mean, I don't know Lady Gaga, but I know some famous people and they're pretty fucking cool.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And the nice thing is,
talented people and people who are grateful for where they've ended up. And you know, people don't usually get to these places without a lot of help from good people too. So I think there's just an element of gratefulness that comes from playing at that level where you could, if you're going to be a dickhead, then you don't really last that long unless you're imperative to some act where somebody is smoothing things over for you. Otherwise, people will just go off, you know. So. Yeah.
Sly and the Family Stone. Like Sly, he got kicked out of the business.
Right. Yeah.
Like people are just like, no, man, sorry, you're no longer allowed to do this with us.
Yeah, yeah.
What a bummer, too. He
was killer,
so killer, man. There was something.
Well, and the nice thing.
Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry.
No, please.
Well, I was just going to add on to what you were saying about these people. You know, it's great to be able to play with these people and to be able to, you know, hear these stories and stuff. You know, one day when, you know, 20, 30 years down the road, it'll be the musicians of my age that have toured with these bands that will be the only ones who can really tell the stories that they're telling.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, that's you could say that musically, and you can say that, you know, in a social setting too. Some of those stories are better than the songs. You know, the stories are the getting to the gigs or the weird things that happen and all this, you know, they're like musician lore, you know?
Oh yeah, dude. Yeah. I mean, that's part of the reason why I started this show. I used to do this shit at like 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning at a, you know, in the backstage of a bar getting thrown out of somewhere. But
yeah,
I do it in the day.
Yeah, right. Well, it's a great concept. I love it.
Thanks, and, buddy.
Yeah.
So you're going to be touring the States, the East Coast, basically April 16th, 6th through the 17th. 6th through the 17th. You start off at Rockwood Music Hall. I love playing there. I love that place.
Yeah, it's a nice place.
Yeah. The other thing is you're going to be coming back again like later on in the summer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think in July is the next set of dates, and there's some Colorado dates, and there's some Arizona dates, and there's some Californian dates.
Dude, those are like, Colorado is a great place to be in the summer, man.
Oh yeah, man.
So beautiful. I've done
a few things there, and I played with Skinner there at the Fiddler's Green Amphitheater. Well, man, that was awesome.
That's awesome. So funny to be able to say I played with Skinner there, right? I mean, that's pretty fucking rad.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was certainly a funny introduction to America, you know, like the first time I even just traveled around the country. And, you know, I used to go and skip into these little dive bars and stuff like that, you know, in some less than, you know, reputable areas of the States, and
people
would hear my English accent, and sometimes it was a bit touch and go until I showed them the pictures of what I was doing, and then it was like, right, okay. drinks are in.
Yeah, well, dude, man, it's been really great talking, and this record Ride is gorgeous. It comes out April 8th. This podcast will be out next week, but you're really 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 talented songwriter, great singer, an amazing guitar player, really this is just a really great record. It's been really great getting to meet you and talk to you.
Thank you, Johnny. And well, I look forward to seeing you when I come through Austin next.
Yeah, man, me too.
Yeah, and just best of luck with continued luck with the podcast. I'm going to start listening to it from now on too. So, yeah, have you got anyone else coming up? You got anyone else coming up soon? Should be looking out for.
I'm thinking. Yeah, I've got, I just had this guy, Walter Martin from this band, The Walkman. It's a good guy. I've had some good guys on you ever listen to like Ray Wiley Hubbard or any guys like that?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Seems like you might like a guy like that. I had a good one with him a while back, but yeah, man, I'll stay in touch and follow you. People can find you at jackbroadbent.co.uk. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, Instagram, Facebook, all that jazz, and you can actually you can pre-order the record on vinyl and CD.
Oh, fantastic!
Through the website, and also through links in the bio of all the social media stuff. So that's on track now too. So
how's that vinyl sound?
Hope everyone enjoys it. It sounds absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
I think this is a record that really is made for vinyl.
Totally.
And especially just, you know, in terms of the track listing of it, it sits really nice as an A-B thing, you know, so it very much feels like a side one and a side two record, which is great.
Yeah. Well, fantastic, dude. Yeah. Great talking to you.
Awesome, Johnny.
And have a great one, man. Good luck.
Thanks very much, dude.
See you, buddy. We put dreams in our That was Jack Broadbent. His 6th album, Ride, drops April 1st, this Friday. Wherever it is you stream and download your jams, go to jackbroadbent.co.uk. And if you live in New York or in the East Coast, go check him out. See, he'll be out there touring from the 6th to the 17th, starting out Wednesday, April 6th, next Wednesday at Rockwood Music Hall in New York. One of my favorite places to play there in New York City. In New York City. Great talking to Jack Broadbent. Go to jackbroadbent.co.uk for all of your Jack Broadbent needs. And gang, don't forget when you're out there checking out Jack Broadbent, you can subscribe to this podcast. Follow us. Leave a rating anywhere you find podcasts. Do it. Leave us a rating. If you can leave a comment, leave a comment. If you're a Jack Broadbent fan and you enjoyed this podcast, share it. do what you can. Have a great, great week, whatever it is you're doing. Let's get down.
Take my stand. Now it's time for you to take my